Hebrews is made up of five primary exhortations. Now, you remember the first three exhortations? Drifting, the danger of drifting from the word because of neglect. Very good. Not anchored, remember? And the danger of doubting and disbelieving the word because of hardness of heart, and the danger of what? Oh yeah, dullness of hearing because of reverse momentum, remember? Now, we're moving on to a fourth exhortation here. Now, if you'll notice, well, you probably don't, I can't show you on the slide here, but we've gotten up to the end of Hebrews chapter 6. And our fourth exhortation is really given to us in Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews 10 concludes with, and I'm going to kind of label this two separate exhortations, but they're kind of wrapped up into one. So this is exhortation 4a and 4b. And this, because it's really for the end of the fourth chapter following where we are with the third exhortation, there's a lot of material there to get us to that fourth and fifth exhortation. And it's a whole lot of material. Now, we're not going to cover it today by any means, but chapter 7, chapter 8, and chapter 9 are all dealing with the priesthood of Christ as being supreme over the Aaronic or the Levitical priesthood. And then it follows with this fourth exhortation, or fourth and fifth exhortation. And so we'll tie those together, and you'll see how he's spending a lot of time to give us this exhortation. And so we'll have to make sure that we take care to note it. For if we sin willfully after we have received the knowledge of the truth, you can see there he's wrapping this around the idea of the word again, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful expectation of judgment and fiery indignation which will devour the adversaries. Now again, as we've seen in some of the strong language that he uses in the book of Hebrews, this is not about someone losing their salvation. This is not about someone who's maybe not truly saved or something of that nature. This is a fiery indignation that comes to a believer, potentially, because of living a life of obedience. And anyone who has regarded Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will he be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified? So there it is. Clearly, this is talking about a believer, someone that was sanctified. But then you begin again to count the blood a common thing and insulted the Spirit of grace. That is to take the sacrifice that Christ did for us, and we saw that vividly this morning in Sunday school class, if you were there, the portrayal of that from the movie. You see all the blood that he shed, and you think about making light of that in your own life, and it's just painful. It's hard. That's hard to watch, and we don't even, and that doesn't, the movie doesn't even really do it justice. As far as that goes. So I'm labeling this one this way, 4a. The danger of despising the word, got to have a D in there, despising the word because of callousness that comes about. And the callousness comes, now callousness and hard of heart is kind of the same thing, I recognize, but this is a little bit different. This is specifically not recognizing the difference between who Christ is versus something else. And we'll see that fleshed out here as we go back to chapter 7 and 8. But now we've got to get 4b. Okay, directly following that passage we just read is this: therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. Now remember, the book of Hebrews is a book of encouragement. Keep on keeping on. Get to the end. Make sure you stick with it. And don't go back to the old ways. And so, therefore, do not cast away your confidence. What does that infer? That you have confidence, right? Don't give it up. You've got the confidence. You know what you need to be doing. Don't give it up. Because why? There is a great reward that comes about from not casting it away, not giving it up. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. So there's a second exhortation. I want you to help me with this one, all right? Now, what is the exhortation here? Remember, we got to have the D word, right? And so let's look at it this way. What are some key words that are in this particular passage? Confidence. All right. We got that one. Give me another one. What? Reward. Reward. Okay, that's good. Endurance. Okay. Receive. Receive the promise. All right. There's at least two more that I've highlighted. Cast away. Okay. Therefore, do not cast away. Yeah. And one more. Yeah, you saw the mouse pointer change, didn't you? All right. And done the will of God. So there's the key words as I see this. He's talking about confidence, reward, not casting away, endurance, promise, doing the will of God. So so here's how I flesh that. If those are the key words, give me an exhortation here. And I'll give you a clue. I'm highlighting the word confidence. And it's opposite of confidence, a D word. What? And it can't be doubting because we've already used that one. Not discouraged. What? No. If you were to look up the word confidence in a thesaurus under the antonym section, you would find the word diffidence. It's a real word. Come on. All right, I did. I had to look it up because that didn't come to my mind either. But hey, someone's calling me. Hold on. But diffidence is the opposite of confidence. It is to now. I want you to think about this. I'm confident. What is that picture? Some bull and it just knows what they're doing and they march on and nothing's going to persuade them from getting off the path. But if I'm diffident, then I forgot to use my. Then I forgot to put in my. Short-sightedness. And what's the short-sightedness here? You don't recognize the fact that there's a reward, and you get off the path because you want to take the easier way. And so, or we could say this way. Maybe this is a better way to put it: discarding confidence. Because we got to put the word in there. So discarding confidence in the word because of short-sightedness. Like that casting away idea came in. So here we have the pictures. Now, I don't know if you can tell from there, but that's someone stomping on grapes. Okay? And that's how you make wine. And I don't know if they really make wine that way or not anymore. But anyhow, they still have these wine-stomping festivals. And you can go in and you can stomp the grapes and squish them. I never understood how that worked with athlete's foot and all that kind of stuff. But anyhow, but now I have that picture there because when we see this in chapter 7, chapter 8, and chapter 9, it's talking about the superiority of Christ as the high priest, but also as the sacrifice. And that's one of the things that makes him superior is that he's not only the one who brings the sacrifice. In fact, he doesn't bring it. He is the sacrifice. So he's a different kind of high priest. And when you despise him, you count the blood as something common to just be discarded like wine or like grape juice, just stomping on it. And you know, the picture here, really, if you think about from Josh's lesson, remember the crimson and the what's the other red word? What? Scarlet, the scarlet and the crimson, and that's a picture of that specific kind of bug that they squish to get the red juice out of. Remember, but I couldn't find a picture of anyone stomping on those bugs. So this is as close as I could get. But here it is, because of the disregard for the sacrifice, or this picture, timidness, that's a turtle. He's gone back into his shell, and he's got his glasses on, and so he's timid because of short-sightedness, all right? Now, the foundation of this exhortation, number 4, is given at the end of chapter 10, but the story begins at chapter 7, and so we've got to go back to chapter 7 to pick this up and to get it. Now, in chapter 7 through 10, we're going to see the superior priesthood, and details the supremacy of a better order as compared to Melchizedek, a better covenant as compared to the Mosaic, a better sacrifice compared to the animals. And there's an expected response, which is the exhortation, number 4a and b. Now, within the better order, there are three different things he's going to highlight here. This is all chapter 7 that we're going to be looking at. There's a historical argument of the better order over Melchizedek. There's the doctrinal argument, and there's a practical argument. And so we're going to see those all in chapter 7, and that's where we're going to get today. So ramp up to chapter 7. The end of chapter 6 said this: "The hope we have is an anchor for the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which enters the presence behind the veil where the forerunner has entered for us. Even Jesus, having become high priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek." Now, how much do you know about Melchizedek? The Bible tells us a whole lot. There's two sentences in the Bible about Melchizedek. And it's we'll look at them here, maybe three sentences, depending on how you parse it. But not a whole lot of room is given to Melchizedek in the Bible. It's fascinating to me that the Holy Spirit, who authored the Bible, is able to draw this whole section in Hebrews, making a comparison of Jesus, and he's in the order of Melchizedek, and the supremacy of Melchizedekian priesthood, and all that. Given just a little tiny bit in the Old Testament in Genesis, and one little statement given to us in Psalms, but he is the author of the whole thing, and so he knows what he's doing when he does that. So this Melchizedek, and here's what he tells us in Hebrews: king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth of all, first being translated king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, meaning king of peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. Now there's some odd verbiage in here, and we're going to talk about that here in just a minute, because you read this at face value, and maybe he's like Jesus or something. He doesn't have a father, doesn't have a mother, no genealogy, just kind of poof, appeared on the earth somewhere. And that's not really the picture that he's trying to portray for us, and we'll talk about that. So let's go back to Genesis and read the account. Not much to read. "And the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Sheva." This is after Abraham had gone down, gotten the goods back from Sodom, from the kings that had taken from Sodom. "And after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him. And then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought him out wine and bread, and he said, 'The priest of God Most High.' And he," Melchizedek, "blessed him, Abe, and said," I'm on first name basis for those guys, Mel and Abe. "And he said, 'Blessed be Abram of God Most High, and possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand.' And he," Abe, "gave him," Mel, "a tithe of all." That's it from the book of Genesis, and we'll see one more phrase in Psalm. Now, one thing you got to key in here, though, is he is the priest of the God Most High. Now, was this before or after the book of Deuteronomy and Leviticus and all those were written? This is before, right? And so, what do we know about the priests of the God Most High from back in that time? What he says right here, and that's about it, that there was one. At least one, right? I would assume there were probably many, or in succession. Doesn't tell us how they got to be appointed that. Doesn't tell us how Abraham knew that he was. Doesn't tell us what he wore or what he ate or what he ate. Well, it does tell you he ate bread and drank wine, so we knew that about him. But it doesn't tell us anything about the guy. But we know that there was a system in place there. And this is an important concept about the Bible, is we get progressive revelation. He doesn't give us information we don't need to know, but the stuff we need to know, he gives us more and more and more until we get to the point where we need to be. And so Abraham gave him a tithe. So let's read about the account in Psalm 110. This is the only thing it says. And he's talking, this is a messianic psalm. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And he goes on, then he says, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, if I were the writer of the book of Hebrews, and I'm gonna write three chapters, in particular one chapter at least, chapter 7, all about Christ and how he's in the order of Melchizedek, and how much do I have to draw from the Old Testament knowledge? I got this right here. Now, what does it tell you about the writer of Hebrews? Well, it tells me two things. One, he must have been inspired. Because either that or you're just making stuff up. I prefer the latter, or earlier, however that goes. And but what else? He must have known his Bible pretty good, because it doesn't talk a whole lot about Melchizedek in the whole Bible, so he knew of Melchizedek. He knew Psalm 110 pretty well, didn't he? Okay? So, now, this is what this concept is. This is a type, an anti-type. All right? Now, anti-type is not like anti-freeze, but it's the one is the thing, and the other thing is the thing that it points to. In typology, these are with those highfalutin words that describe what's going on here. Melchizedek is the type, Christ is the antitype. He's the one who fulfills it. So in John chapter 3, another example of a type, antitype, is this. Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man must be lifted up. So what in this passage is the type? What? The serpent in particular is being lifted up, and then the antitype then is the Son of Man being lifted up. And so you see how that works. Type, antitype, Melchizedek, and Christ. Now, as we go back, and let's pick up some more details here. So Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abram returning from slaughter, and he was the king of righteousness and the king of Salem, meaning king of peace. Well, which is it? Is he the king of righteousness or is he the king of peace? I'm a little confused. Well, he is the king of righteousness because his name, Melchizedek, Sedek, the Hebrew word Sedek, and we'll see that in a second, is the word for righteousness. So his name itself, it can be translated king of righteousness. But he was, his title was king of Salem. And so he is both. Salem means peace, Hebrews say shalom. Salem, shalom, or Jerusalem, and Jerusalem would really be kind of the idea. So he is, his name is translated King of Righteousness, and it'd be kind of like President Bush. His name means can of beans, like Bush beans, but he is the king of the United States. Something you get that? Okay. So he's got both those things going on there. Now, so the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Sedek is Hebrew for righteousness. And his title was king of Salem, or peace. And thus he was the king of righteousness by name. And he is the king of peace by title. Okay? Now, we do know a little bit more about Melchizedek, interestingly, from history. And we don't want to rely on this too much because this is extra biblical. And we don't need to rely on it because it doesn't necessarily... we don't need to rely on anything if the Bible tells us, and we just believe it. But it's nice that we have some history about this as well. Not too long ago, there was a woman digging in Egypt for some. She wanted some ancient dust for her garden, and she had found some tablets that had been buried, and she was taking those tablets and she was grinding them up and getting the dust and putting them into her garden, because for whatever reason she felt like that would help her garden to grow better, because it was ancient dust. Well, she kept doing this, and no one knows how many of these tablets she destroyed before someone said, hey, that tablet might be worth something. And so she said, oh, really? And so, they got whatever was left of those tablets, excavated it, and this is a place called El Amarna in Egypt. And so these tablets that were found there at the Tell El Amarna. The Amarna tablets were found in Egypt, written, they were a bunch of tablets that were written to the Pharaoh at the time, which is Amenhotep IV, who later changed his name to Akhenaten, around 1300. And it was written, interestingly enough, from various kings of the Canaan city-states, including Salem, which later became Jerusalem. All right. Now, who is the king of Salem? Oh, Melchizedek. And so they found these letters that these people had written, and then the letters were transcribed onto these Egyptian cuneiforms, and they were recorded. And then this lady was digging them up and grinding them up. But they found some that had some interesting history on it. The tablets speak of Melchizedek's predecessor, Ebed-Tob, who specifically mentions Melchizedek. And Ebed-Tob writes of Mel, and he says, "It was not my father. It was not my father. It was not my mother who established me in this position. At that time, Canaan, which was a city-state, at that time Canaan and her city-states, such as Jerusalem, were vassals to Egypt. And so you understand the city-state concept, right? Canaan was kind of the region, and then there would be the city that was kind of walled in, and it was its own kingdom, right? And it would have its own king, such as Melchizedek. But the kings weren't descendants from their parents. Every one of them was appointed by Pharaoh, and that's what a vassal state is like. And so there was no ancestral heritage. Now that's interesting if you keep that in mind when you come back to here, and it says, he was without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. If you look at this from a historical perspective, it's not that Melchizedek had immaculate conception, and not even that, but even more, it just sprouted up from a bean or something. That wasn't the case. He was, by record, there is no record of his father, there's no record of his mother. And, of course, there wouldn't be a record of his mother or father, even in the Amarna tablets, because it wasn't significant, because he was appointed by the Pharaoh. And so there's no record of his mother, there's no record of his father, he got no record of genealogy, and so in essence, as a type goes, he's like Christ. And so he's like the Son of God in some respects like that. There's a comparison there. Now, keep in mind that types are not exact replicas. They're not like photocopies. There's similarities, and that's where we draw the line. So Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the God Most High, met Abraham, and he was returning, and he positioned a portion to tithe of everything to him. Now, so there's a similarity between Mel and the son. And by the way, there is so much stuff in chapter 7, 8, and 9 what I'm going to try to do here, we're going to read it all, and this is going to be primarily reading, but I'm going to try to give you a little summary of each of the sections as we go through here so you can kind of follow along with me. Now, in chapter 7, verse 4, "But see how great he must be," talking about Melchizedek. "If Abraham, the patriarch, gave him a tithe of the plunder, and those of the sons of Levi who received the priestly office of authorization according to the law to collect a tithe from the people, that is from their fellow countrymen, although they too are descendants of Abraham. But Melchizedek, who does not share their ancestry, collected a tithe from Abram and blessed the one who possessed the promise. Now without dispute, the inferior is blessed by the superior. And in one case, tithes are received by mortal men, while in the other, by him who is affirmed to be alive." Now again, we're looking at a type here. And so that's not that Melchizedek is still alive, but the concept is this. Look, Melchizedek comes along and gives Abraham gives Melchizedek a tithe. So who is the greater, Melchizedek or Abraham? Melchizedek is greater because you give the tithe to the one who's greater, right? And so now, what does that by proxy make the descendants of Abraham? Lesser or greater than Melchizedek? Lesser. So if you got Melchizedek, Abraham, and by natural descendant, all his descendants are lesser than Melchizedek as well. Now, one case they're received by tithes are received by mortal men, the Levites, and in the other case they're received by someone who continues to live. Now, keep in mind the type is kind of moving into this picture of Christ, and so ultimately we're looking at Christ who doesn't die, who is alive, and who remains that way. So there's the supremacy being set up. Keep in mind also that Melchizedek is here, Abraham's here, but Melchizedek and Christ are the comparison. So if Melchizedek is here, then Christ is here, and so everything else is below Christ as well. It could be said that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid a tithe through Abraham, because he was still in his ancestor Abraham's loins when Melchizedek met him. So in other words, that descendancy is also inferior. So Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, which is by nature greater than the Levites as well. And not only is he greater, as we'll see in the next section, but Mel even replaced Aaron. And that's what he's going to talk about now, because it goes on forever. So if perfection had in fact been possible through the Levitical priesthood, on that basis, the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arrive, said to be in the order of Melchizedek, and not in Aaron's order? So, if it was possible for this, if the Levitical priesthood was perfect, then there wouldn't be a need for another one. But it's not perfect. So the rhetorical answer is, perfection wasn't possible because another one did arise. Now, look at this thing of perfection. And actually, we're not going to look at this because we don't have time. But there are several passages, there's eight of them in Hebrews where it talks about perfection. And the idea about perfection in Hebrews is not necessarily perfect in the way we think of it, but it's completion, it's fulfillment, it's the total thing being there. For when the priesthood changes, a change in the law must come as well. Yet the one these things are spoken about belongs to a different tribe, and no one from that tribe has ever officiated at the altar. For it's clear that our Lord is descended from Judah, yet Moses said nothing about the priests in connection with that tribe. And this is even clearer if another, and this is the Greek word here, is another of a different type priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest not by a legal regulation about physical descent, but by the power of indestructible or endless life. So in other words, look, if the law, the American law says that we don't have any provision for a king. And if George Bush decided that he wanted to be king, then how would that come about? And some might argue that he's already decided that for himself. I don't know. But if he wanted to be king, what would have to happen? What? Yeah, you'd have to change the laws. The same thing goes on here. The law says you got to have a Levitical priesthood, line of Aaron. So if you want a different kind of priest, then you got to change the law. Same thing. And so what happened? Christ came and he fulfilled the law, and so that's exactly what took place. So the Levitical priesthood was insufficient. Perfection couldn't come. Another one did come, and the law itself was by nature insufficient as well, because it couldn't handle that former statute. Now, so we go on. For here is the testimony about him. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. This is the quote from Psalm. On the one hand, a former command is set aside because it's weak and useless, for the law made nothing perfect. On the other hand, a better hope is introduced, through which we draw near to God. Keep in mind, again, book of Hebrews is a book of encouragement. Get there. Hang on. Don't go back to the weak. Don't go back to the useless. But stick with what is better. There's a better hope that is introduced for us. So the old is weak and useless. The new brings us into his presence. Chapter 7, verse 20. And since this was not done without sworn affirmation, for the others have become priests without a sworn affirmation, but Jesus did so with a sworn affirmation by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever." Accordingly, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant. Now, who guaranteed it? Jesus is the guarantee, but who made that a guarantee? The one who appointed him. And how did he do that? By giving the Holy Spirit, who seals the deal, right? And we'll look at that as we get to chapter 8. And the others who became priests were numerous because death prevented them from continuing in office, but he holds his priesthood permanently since he lives forever. So he's able to save completely those who come to God through him because he always lives to intercede for them. They couldn't do it. They die, they have to be replaced, but he, one sacrifice, one eternal person, is able to do that forever. So he's the guarantee of a better covenant, and he offers an effective salvation, whereas the others ultimately couldn't. And then finally in 26, for it is indeed fitting for us. Now, by the way, let's back up a little bit. We were looking back here at the historical perspective. He's comparing Melchizedek, right? Then we go to the doctrinal perspective, and we're looking at doctrines. He's talking about the law and perfection and all that kind of stuff that comes about. And then we finally come down to the practical. This is the third perspective. For it is indeed fitting for us to have such a high priest. He's holy, he's innocent, he's undefiled, he's separate from sinners and exalted above the heavens. He has no need to do every day what these priests do, to offer sacrifices first for their own sins and then for the sins of the people, since he did this in offering himself once for all. For the law appoints as high priests men subject to weaknesses, but the word of solemn affirmation that came after the law appoints a son made perfect forever. No need for daily sacrifice, and it is an eternal, perfect, indomitable, meaning there's no weakness, priest, or sacrifice. So let's look at this. There's the historical argument, the similarity between Melchizedek and the son. Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, greater than the Levites. No, not only is he greater, but he replaced Aaron. The doctrinal argument, the perfection wasn't previously possible. The Levitical priesthood and the law were insufficient. The old is weak and useless. The new brings us into his presence. He is the guarantee of a better covenant. He brings effective salvation. And the practical says there's no need for the daily sacrifices because he is that everlasting sacrifice. He is an eternal, perfect, indomitable priest or sacrifice. So let's give a comparative analysis. Now, I've been having to do this at my office. Our company split, and so we're having to refocus and reinvent our marketing strategies and blah, blah, blah. And so what we had to do, we've spent like 6 weeks now looking at all the competition, and we say, well, the competition does this, but we do this, the competition does this. And, of course, everything we do is better. You know, so you got the check marks for us and the X's for them, right? Well, there's some fluff that goes along with that, or actually what you do is you just kind of don't mention the things they do better, and you just talk about things that we do better. Not that hopefully no one's ever going to listen to this presentation that's one of our competition. Anyhow, he did the comparative analysis for us in this passage. Now, I'm not going to skip the stuff that talks about the Levitical priesthood actually being better because I don't have to. There is none. And so here it is. There's talking about span. Well, that one was temporal. This is eternal. There's blessings. The Levitical priesthood by proxy gave, but the Melchizedekian received. And by comparison, this is talking about Christ. One, perfection. Ding, ding, ding. What about descent? Is that the right way of spelling that? Descent as opposed to decent? I don't know. But, you know, ancestry. And so one is physical, one is power of life. Talking about power, one is weak and useless. The other one allows us to draw near to God. Affirmation. Yes. What about guarantee of a better? No. Yes. What about number of priests? Infinite. Only one. What about duration? One is a lifetime, which is sometimes short, and one is eternal. What about salvation? Partial? Complete. What about holy? No. Yes. What about innocent? True. What about undefiled? Can't do it, but he is. What about sanctified? Not there, but he is. exalted above the heavens? Certainly not. And how about other offer sacrifices for his own sins? Well, they had to, but he doesn't. And then finally, they are weak, but he is strong. And he is vastly superior. Now, the problem I have with all this is I'm personally not struggling in the area of considering going back to the Levitical priesthood system. I don't think I've ever considered that in my life. And so I think to myself, this is all nice, but why do I really care about this? Because, frankly, I'm never going to go to the temple and give a sacrifice. Never even thought about doing that, even if there was a temple there. But keep this in mind. He's bringing us all towards this exhortation. And all of Scripture is profitable for us as well. Ultimately, where he's heading with this is saying, don't despise the word. Don't trample the grapes. Don't count the blood a common thing because you're disregarding the sacrifice. And ultimately, discarding the confidence in the word because of short-sightedness. We have, on many facets, many angles and many perspectives, should have confidence in the Son and in the Son alone because he is the one. The sacrifice was well thought out and planned. Now, we don't know much about Melchizedek, but it's interesting that he gave us just enough to be able to demonstrate for us that there was, even back there, a plan in place to show that Abraham is not the top dog. And that this guy shows up on the scene, Abraham gives him a tithe, and the psalmist records the incident as well from a little different perspective, and then we can pick up on that and see, he's not the top guy. It was orchestrated from the beginning, and it results in a vastly superior system that should never be disregarded from any perspective. Now, you may be relying on maybe not an inferior Levitical priesthood, but we can rely on many things that are inferior in our own lives to try to get us through whatever it is we're going through. And for him, it is always to go back to and focus on who he is, what he's done, the supremacy of Christ, and the superiority of who he is, and the sacrifice, not making light of that. And that's how we are to carry on our lives, much as the same way the Hebrews were to do as well. We'll pray. Lord, thank you for your grace. It is alone sufficient. Your sacrifice was superior. You are sovereign. You're holy. You are not subject to weakness. You are superior in all ways. And I pray that we would constantly focus on that and not our own troubles and difficulties that tend to turn us away from you as it would have for the recipients of the book of Hebrews. I pray that you will be our focus in all things that we do and say. In Jesus' name, amen.